Lynn Scherr is on with me. She has been on 2020 on ABC TV for 20 years now. She has won an Emmy Award. She's won a Peabody Award. She has written a couple of books and now is out with another one. It's called Outside the Box, a memoir of her life in and out of TV over the past few decades. I'm happy to have her on here because I want to know how she manages to make those graphics look so cool on election night coverage. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to KMOX.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for remembering. You know, I still, when I walk down the street in New York City, people stop me and ask me the same question. That was the 92 election when they did this fabulous whiz-bang set of graphics for me, and it looked as if I was pushing buttons and these holograms were rising from my desk. Wasn't that just the coolest thing in the world?
That was very cool. It was like you were in a virtual studio.
It was, and it was so much fun. And there's a picture of it in the book. I've included a photograph of it that we got off the screen because you couldn't have taken the picture in the studio because none of it was happening in the studio. It was all little ones and zeros that were being done up on another floor, and we just sort of pulled it all together and made it look that way. God, that was fun. It was just fabulous.
I want to talk to you about so many things that you've covered through the years, but since we started off with elections, let's start right there. Since you've worked on both election nights and conventions, how has covering politics in this country from a TV correspondent's perspective changed in the years that you've been doing it?
Well, the major way it's changed is that everything is much more scripted today. Everything is much more manipulated. Everything is much more planned by the candidates. When I started covering politics, don't you hate sentences that start like that? When I started covering politics, but when I started covering politics as a truly young child, I did a little in college, but seriously, starting in 1968. Things happened on convention floors. Decisions were made. Politicians could be spontaneous and could give you an answer to a question without having 32 focus groups to determine what it was they were going to say. And now the combination of the primacy of television news and how that's sort of taken over everything, and the fact that with all the reforms, the primary system and the caucuses, which are done by the people, determine pretty much who the candidates are going to be. By the time you get to a convention, there's really no news whatsoever.
Yeah, it's all about image, isn't it?
It's PR. It's all public relations. And I've always said that I thought we should cover the conventions on television live because it is a great big civics lesson, and I love that people sit there and watch their representatives and their senators go at it. But I'm wondering now if the time hasn't passed and maybe we need a new model to make these things happen, because the conventions are simply no longer the way decisions get made. And that's too bad because they were terrific to cover.
Yeah, but when it comes to television that the viewers are really interested in, they're well past their prime, aren't they?
I think so, because I think the viewers are pretty smart, and the viewers know when they're watching something real and when they're watching something not real. And the way those are all managed, you know, it's all staged and managed. And are we partly to blame, television news? Perhaps, because we said, well, we want it only in certain hours and we want to make money off of our commercials and blah, blah, blah. So the parties have been in a position where they also have to go and, gin up something interesting. So I would rather we get back to real stuff, real news, real stuff that's happening. But I don't hold your breath. It's not going to happen with politics.
I don't think so either. Although I don't blame TV. I think it's that the politicians wised up to the image-making possibilities and the handlers stepped in and they said, spontaneity is a bad thing. We will script it and we will rehearse it and we will go out there and we will present the candidate in exactly the way we want to present it. And it's not just candidates now. It's people holding political office. The same thing. We're not going to answer real questions. We're not going to offer real opportunities because that would get us off message.
Well, it's true. And when I keep saying how sad it is because it was fun, it was not only fun, it was good for the public. I think the public got a lot more out of it because there was good, serious, hard reporting. Not that there's not now, but there are fewer opportunities when they script everything, the politicians themselves. And it's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I want people to understand times have changed. I want them to understand that there was a time when politics was an art form, that it was real, it was genuine, and it's one of the many things, like my own business, that have changed over the years.
Now, all of that said, give me a couple of fun stories from those nights when you were working the floor at a convention.
Oh, my gosh.
It got a little crazy, didn't it?
It got nuts. You know, you would get bumped. You would have someone blowing a horn in your ear. You would have 37 people screaming, hi, hi, while your camera was on. I remember one night when Trent Lott was the speaker, I had to, I'm the majority leader, excuse me, I had him cooling his heels for about 20 minutes while we were in commercial break, and then something else happened. I kept screaming into my mic to my producer, I've got Trent Lott here, I've got Trent Lott, and you know, that was the end of that. I mean, he waited, he was great, he was gracious, and of course, when you're off camera, they're all very charming, and the minute you go on camera, boom, then they go into their game face, and you go into political mode. A lot of that. Then there was the night on the floor of the convention, the Democratic convention in San Francisco in 1984 when Geraldine Ferraro was nominated as vice president.
Mm.
It was tumultuous. It was absolutely tumultuous. There were women who were crying. There were women who were screaming, laughing. The very idea that there was a woman, sort of one of us up there, was overwhelming. It was a very exciting moment.
You know, some people talk about there being bias in the media. And I'm wondering, in an event like that, here's the first woman of a major party to run for the presidency, or in her case, the vice presidency. You're a woman there covering this. Do you have a bias in her favor, not because of her politics, but because of her gender night?
No question. Not only did I cover her that night, I was the candidate. I was the correspondent who covered the Ferraro campaign. And I will tell you without any question, I had a bias in favor of her gender. Did that mean I could not cover her fairly? Not for one second. Did it mean I was any less tough on her? I would have been on a male politician? Not for one second. I've now gone over all my old stories, all my clips, everything I wrote and said and did on the air, and it's right down the middle, and ABC never would have put it on the air if it hadn't been. So I'm allowed to have feelings. I'm allowed to be excited. It doesn't mean it interferes with my ability to report the story fairly and in a way that people will understand it.
All right, that was 1984. Here we are approaching the 2006 elections and 2 years away from another presidential election, and there's a woman who people keep talking about as possibly one of the candidates, Hillary Clinton. Do you think in the two decades that have passed since Geraldine Ferraro that the bias, gender bias, is still there? Will there be female correspondents who will look at Hillary that same way, or has it changed?
Oh, I think in terms of who the correspondents are, that has changed. There is no question but that on the Ferraro campaign plane, there were more female correspondents, camera women, and print reporters than I'd ever seen before. I think it's all changed. It's more than 20 years later, as you say. That's a huge difference. I also think the country, and from the polling we know, the country can handle a female president, absolutely. The country is ready for it. By the way, what's taken us so long? You know, it took us 50 years to get a woman in the anchor seat, a sole anchor seat at a network news. Many, many other countries, big countries included, have had women as heads of state. Why is it taking us so long? I've said all along, by the way, that I think the first female president will be a Republican. That's what I've always assumed. I wasn't thinking of anyone specific, but that was just my sense of the way things were going. Will Senator Clinton pull it off? I have absolutely no idea.
And by the way, anybody who says they do have an idea now in September of 2006 is just making stuff up. They don't have no idea.
Dumb. I mean, there's way too much still to happen. One of the most important things I ever learned as a political correspondent, never make predictions.
Lynn Scherr, the book is Outside the Box, a memoir of her two decades at 2020 and covering so many more things in her years as a network correspondent and as a reporter. Who have you seen in politics who you thought would do better but didn't, and why?
Well, go back to Ferraro for a minute. I was sure they would do better. They, of course, only won one state, the Mondale-Ferraro ticket in 1984. And what was interesting was that her turnout was extraordinary. Women from both sides of the aisle, Democrats, Republicans, and everything in between, turned out to see her because there was a genuine excitement about having a woman in that role. It never translated into votes, which we knew pretty early on, but it didn't feel that way from the very beginning. But starting out on the trail, we knew what was happening. I'll tell you somebody else, Senator Glenn. I covered John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth, ran for president in the primaries that year in 1984, and was a disastrous campaign. Probably one of the greatest gentlemen in the United States Senate, a true American hero, bad campaigner, did not translate into votes.
Bad politician or bad presidential campaigner? Because the guy got elected to the Senate.
Bad presidential campaigner. He's not a good speechmaker, and his positions were never particularly well-defined, but a prince of a man.
Are the networks to a point where when we get to election night this year, they'll have a better idea how to make exit polls work correctly?
God, I hope so.
Are you going to be doing that again?
No, I don't do it anymore. No, my last one was 2000. You remember 2000?
Yeah. That's the one where you got no sleep and neither did I.
You got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was quite a night. And I'll tell you, I love the exit polls. There, you know, been a couple of hiccups along the way, but they've been very, very reliable. Not necessarily for predicting who's going to win, but for telling us what is the makeup of this fabric of the electorate out there. And I've always loved doing the exit polls on election night because it's the most interesting information. Who voted for whom and why? I just love it. So I'm hoping we'll have a lot more of it. We got a little gun shy, in 2004, but I'm not sure what ABC News is preparing for 2008. Of course, the off-year elections are a little bit different, but they were always just fabulously exciting to cover and lead me to one of my major beliefs still, which is I think voting should be mandatory. I got so depressed by the low turnout in so many elections. I know it's gone up and down. There's really been no trend. But I think Americans ought to have to vote. I think it's not just a privilege. It's a responsibility. And I would love to see everybody out there voting every single time.
No, I got to disagree with you. Because, you know, there's a lot of talk here in Missouri about the voter photo ID and about the notion of a disenfranchising people. I think the number one thing that disenfranchises people from voting is the politicians.
Well, I don't disagree with that.
I think if you're going to make voting mandatory, you're going to have a box that says none of the above.
Well, perhaps. And let's go away from your voter photo ID for a minute. The concept, though, is that, in addition, anyone who doesn't vote has no right to criticize the government. That's what I think.
Again, you got to have a none of the above, because there are plenty of times when there's a candidate. Many of us have spent most of our lives voting for, you know, I don't like this guy, but I like this guy just
a
little bit less.
Wait a minute. We all make compromises in life.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, if you want to play within the system, you got to go with the system. If you don't like the system, then you should run. Did I just say something bad?
Yeah, you said I should run. I get less states than Mondale. Are you kidding me?
Never mind. I take that back.
One of the things I say often on this show about politics, and I don't make politics a bellwether topic on my show, one of the things that bothers me is that all the political debate in this country is taken up by the 10% of extremists on one side fighting against the 10% of extremists on the other side, and the 80% of us in the middle, both geographically and politically, our real concerns don't get heard, or if they do get heard, they don't get paid attention to, because instead the hot button issues keep popping up again.
I think that's true, and I think one of the lessons for everybody is to sit back and say, what do I want? How do I make it happen? You know, we're all in a world of instant gratification. We want stuff right away. The person you elect is not necessarily going to give you what you want right away, but it might lead to the next phase, which gets you where you want to go. So I think people have to take the bigger picture on that. I mean, it's sort of my philosophy about life. You can't have everything right away. You can get what you want, ultimately, if you stick to your guns and speak your mind.
Lynn, the dedication in your book says, "For Peter, with gratitude for what was." I'm assuming that's Peter Jennings.
It is indeed. Peter was my very, very close friend and, of course, my very respected colleague. Peter set the gold standard in broadcast news. He really raised the bar very high for all of us, and we miss him so much, but he made us all reach to a certain level, and we miss him, but we are grateful for what we had while he was there.
What does having somebody like Peter Jennings or I guess Tom Brokaw over at NBC, what does that mean to you as a correspondent when you're out in the field?
Well, in the case of Peter, it often meant having to go a little further and seek an answer to the extra question that he would throw at you. There was a lot of teasing of Peter, that you would prepare your report and prepare to go live, and then you knew he was going to ask you a question of some sort, and that he would invariably ask you the one question that you had told him you didn't want to talk about, or that you hadn't had time to find out. And the truth is, that's not good enough for our audience. Peter was right. You got to go for it. And we all got on our toes a little bit more and wanted to be able to answer whatever questions he had available. He just, you know, Peter was that rare bird. He was a natural-born broadcaster. He knew what words to put together, what pictures to go with what words to make our audiences care. And I think he drew the very best out of all of us. He was a great man and a great loss.
You have sat in the anchor chair yourself a few times. Did you like it?
I did like it. I much prefer going out and reporting stories. I discovered early on that I didn't want to be indoors, if you will. I wanted to be outdoors with the wind blowing in my hair and the sun on my face and all of that. I like sitting and talking to real people. I don't love celebrity interviews. Depends, of course, on the celebrity. There's some good ones, some bad ones. But I liked the mix that I always had as a correspondent, and am perfectly happy. I love filling in for other people. Anchoring from time to time is fun, but it's going out and getting the stories that for me was the most fun.
Also takes you further away from the vice presidents who will come down to the studio and tell you to change your hair, right?
There is that, and they did that. I mean, more for women than men, although men got it too, but God, looks are important in television. Image counts.
Yeah.
And you just had to get used to all that stuff. I once was told by Rune Arledge, the late president of ABC News, a genius, if I may say so, in every way but this one. I wasn't told by Rune. He didn't like a certain blouse I was wearing. So he calls on Pam Hill, who was then an executive vice president in charge of documentaries, to have a meeting with me to tell me that. I think it was like as if President Bush would say to Condi Rice, I don't like the way Karen Hughes is wearing her lipstick.
Uh-huh.
You know, these guys don't know how to tell women things. So this was, of course, back in the 80s, and it was very funny. And that led to the incident that I describe in my book as having Ralph Lauren, the man, not his clothes, in my bedroom closet helping me figure out which clothes worked and which clothes didn't work.
But if you had that going on an occasional basis, imagine what it must have been like this summer for Katie Couric gearing up to take over the CBS Evening News. I bet there's not an inch of her body that hasn't been scrutinized and possibly focus grouped.
Well, I think you're right, and I think it's too bad. The truth is, there is a higher standard for women than for men. There is no question, but men have many of the same problems. Men have to, these days, have almost as much cosmetic surgery as some women do. I wouldn't know. I've reported all this. I've not done it. But men and women are both doing it. However, it is true that over the years, men have been allowed to get fat and balding and have a lot more wrinkles on the air than women have. There's still a double standard, and that's why so many people are focused on Katie's clothes, which is really too bad.
How do you think she's doing in the anchor chair?
You know, I've only seen one show, and that was the first night, because really I've been on the road so much with my book. You know, she's a talented, very professional person. She'll do fine. I wish her luck, but by the way, not too much luck, because I'm still at ABC News and I want to see Charlie Gibson do really well.
Yeah. Does it matter? You know, we talked before about the female sensibility in covering the Geraldine Ferraro run for the vice presidency.
Right.
Does it matter that there's a woman in that chair as opposed to a man on a nightly basis?
It matters in terms of proving that the network news can reflect what the country looks like a little bit better. It matters in terms of role models for young women and young men. It matters in terms of our being a better place to live on this planet. What does not matter, I think, is having a male or a female in terms of pulling in the audience for what is becoming, unfortunately, an endangered species. The network newses are in trouble at 6 o'clock or 6:30 or 7 o'clock whenever you get your local your network news. The audiences have shrunk because of the availability of news on so many more outlets. You can now get your news on the web, on the Internet, on your iPod, and someday, I firmly believe, on your electric toothbrush. And we're in a position of having to compete with all these things and to say, wait a minute, watch us, watch us. I don't think this has to do with male or female. I think it has to do with how we package things and how compellingly we tell our stories.
Well, I can tell you, since I do some work for Channel 4 here, the CBS affiliate in town, News 4 at 6, I appear there every night after I get off here, they're very happy with the lead-in of Katie at 5:30. It's given them some nice numbers and given their 6 o'clock news a boost. I'd like to take credit for that because we started the same day, but she has better legs than I do.
Well, I think it's you, Paul.
Thank you.
I definitely think it's you. But, you know, this is a long-term problem. This is not a two-week or a one-week or yesterday's ratings problem. This is about getting young people to watch the evening news, and at the moment, they're not, and that's what we're after.
And how, you mentioned the Internet, how has it changed the way you cover the news?
Well, we're now all on 24/7 deadlines. You can no longer have the luxury, which we used to have, and it, by the way, didn't feel like a luxury. It felt like very hard work. Back when I started, which was when there were three networks, and there was an evening newscast, and there was a morning newscast, and that's what you were responsible for. Now there's 24/7 cable. Everybody is pushing to get the news on raw all the time. On the one hand, I love the competition, and I think it's a wonderful thing for everybody. On the other, I really like editors. I think editors serve a great purpose, which is they backstop you. They keep you from writing or saying things that maybe you missed a little tiny piece of. And I don't like all this instant news. I don't like the fact that everybody's in on the news gathering process. Most people don't have time to digest unedited news. They want an edited version. They want a package of what a professional thinks is important. And I worry that by not watching a regular newscast, people are getting dribs and drabs all day long and never sort of seeing the whole picture and the whole context of what's going on in our world.
On the other hand, the Internet also gives you the opportunity as a correspondent, if you're covering a story and they don't have time to squeeze it into one of the evening newscasts or Nightline or even 2020, you can still post the story on abcnews.com.
It's true, and I love that. And the only thing I care about desperately, deeply, is that when a blog becomes opinion rather than fact, it gets labeled opinion rather than fact. I think that there are too many people who are just letting loose, and I think there are too many readers out there who don't know the difference between opinion and fact, and I don't like that confusion. I don't think it's a good thing.
Have you ever had to fight Barbara or Diane or any of your fellow ABC stars for a story?
Oh, sure. That's part of the game, you know. Fighting with Barbara, however, for that is generally a losing proposition. And, you know, a tip of the hat to her. I just saw her yesterday, and I've seen some of the quotes from the show. It's really going to be amazing. And, of course, you know, Barbara trekked over to Australia, landed the interview in the first place, did it, came back, and it will be a real Barbara hour. It's going to be fabulous.
You mentioned in the last segment that you like being edited. Does that mean that you don't like going live?
I love going live. There's a charge, there's a thrill, there's an exhilaration of going live that is wonderful. But if you're trying to do something more thoughtful, I think it's really nice to have an editor to help you be sure it's all put in the right way. It's like writing a book, you know. The words are all mine in this book, but I had an editor and many people who actually read the manuscript, and that was really helpful because there are things that I thought I had explained really well that maybe needed an extra tweak here or a push there. I like that. And I think in terms of what we do on the air, sometimes in the heat of the moment, you might misspeak, you might get something wrong, and it's good to have that backstop. Again, I love going live. There is nothing as exciting as doing it, but I think the public deserves a little bit of thoughtful time in addition to all of the live things we do.
Yeah, because sometimes going live just for the sake of going live or going live to the scene of an emerging story means you're spending all that time on camera and not enough time reporting the story, right?
Well, exactly. And you're dealing with cosmetics, by which I mean the look of something, or you're dealing with the whiz-bang techno-wizardry rather than the substance of the story. When mini-cams, which we're also used to now, and now, of course, they're weeny, tiny little things, originally they were much larger, when they first came in with the idea that you had the capability of covering something from a remote location and sending it back to the studio and putting it on live, this was new in the early 70s. This was new technology. They sent me once, when I was at local news in New York, over to cover, I was at the CBS-owned station, WCBS-TV, sent me over to cover a softball game in Central Park for the 6 o'clock news. I thought it was the dumbest thing I'd ever heard. What they were really doing was testing the technology. But, you know, it was annoying, but that's local news.
But sometimes the technology gets ahead. I'll never forget, a friend of mine was one of the producers on Primetime Live when it was Diane Sawyer and Sam Donaldson, and the show had first gone on the air. And I think it was the first or second or maybe third show, and they went to do a story about an old tree down in Texas. And because everything had to be live on the show, they spent $20,000 lighting the tree at night.
Yeah.
Just so that they could say, and this is what the tree looks like. You know, they could have videotaped it during the day.
And it would have been just fine.
The tree wasn't going anywhere.
It's interesting, though, Paul. What's interesting is the sense of immediacy is important to people, and a little bit of that, I think, is just fine. I think the problem is we don't want the tail wagging the dog. You don't want to show off all your tricks and then forget to get to the root of the story, and that's the part that's important to remember. I wrote my book in part because I wanted an answer for all these kids who come into my office and say, how do I get your job? So it's partly for people that want to come into the business, kind of a how-to, but it's also a how-come. It's this behind-the-scenes stuff we're talking about. For everybody who watches television, this box that has so much power over our lives and doesn't understand how and why certain decisions are being made.
And also, it's very important for them to know a little bit of the history and some of the struggles that you went through as a real pioneer getting on the air. There was a lot of resistance to putting you or any woman on the air, wasn't there?
There sure was. Back in the, the first woman on network television, it was 1960-something, and there was one. She was at NBC, Pauline Frederick. 10 years later, there were maybe half a dozen. When I got in 1972, to local news, women were just being allowed on the air in local television stations all across the country. I should point out this was not because of the generosity of the men who ran the stations. It was because the government was starting to mandate that they had to do it. They had to hire women and minorities. This was all when a group of us got in and kind of the second wave of women, and we essentially said, we're here to stay. By the time we started getting in, I won't say the sex discrimination was gone, but it was starting to. Once we got in, we could cover almost anything. And that's because they realized we didn't have these high, squeaky voices they were scared of. The other argument against us was we had no authority. Nobody would believe us on the air. Well, guess what? That was just dumb.
Yep.
And wrong, right?
Yep.
So once we got there, there was no turning back, I'm sorry to say for them. Happy for us.
Yeah. Lynn, I can't let you go today without talking a little bit about the space program, which you covered, and particularly about your friendship with Sally Ride, which was more than just a reporter covering a story, wasn't it?
We became very, very good friends because I was sent down to NASA. I was brought in to cover the space program in 1981 when the shuttle was starting to gear up. Don't remember, we hadn't had any space for many years since the end of the Apollo program and after Apollo Soyuz. So it was a new group coming in, and I was asked to come in. I had no science background. They liked the way I explained things, however. And I figure if I could ask all the dumb questions and if I could understand this thing, I could explain it to other people. So I got a great education at NASA. One of the first stories I did was the so-called new breed of astronauts. After only having test pilots, which meant essentially white males, and military guys in the program, NASA opened its eyes and said, wait a minute, we could fly other people too. And they put out a call and got a terrific, almost three dozen new people who were scientists, who some of them were pilots, of course, but they were much more, they had many, many more talents than just flying planes. So I was sent down. One of my first stories was the so-called new breed of astronaut. We asked NASA for one of everything. So I got a wonderful African-American guy named Ron McNair, who unfortunately died in the Challenger explosion. I got a great test pilot named Rick Hauck, who's one of the best pilots NASA's ever had. And I got this terrific woman named Sally Ride. And Sally and I just hit it off. And she at the time was married to another astronaut, Steve Hawley. And their home became my kind of home away from home whenever I went to the Johnson Space Center in Houston to cover the shots. It was a great way to meet the other astronauts, to get the inside scoop on a lot of things, and I'm happy to say my friendship with both of them has remained.
And you almost got to go in space yourself.
And I'm still trying, Paul. I'm still trying.
They never sent a journalist up,
no,
did they?
A number of us agitated that they had to send a journalist. We said, this isn't fair. We're the only reporters on the face of this earth who can't go where our stories are. Space is a place. We need to go there. And we agitated. And finally, they started a journalist in space program. I was one of the 40 semifinalists. I was totally convinced I, of course, would be selected,
yep,
knowing nothing. And then after the Challenger explosion, the program was disbanded. I understand their reasoning. I think it's too bad. I think we need reporters in space. And because much as I love so many of the astronauts I've covered, and many of them are brilliant people, generally their description of what they see goes like this. Neat. Cool. Yeah.
Yep.
So I think we need one of us up there, right, to say what's really going on.
I think there are certain reporters who I would not give a return trip to, but you're not one of them. I would certainly give you the round-trip ticket.
And I would still go in a heartbeat.
The book is called Outside the Box, a memoir. Some of the stories we touched on here and many, many more from Lynn Scherr's remarkable career in and outside of the television news business. And she will be in town to do a book signing on November 13th at the Jewish Book Festival. I hope we can spend some more time together when you're here.
I hope so. You know, one of the reasons I love to make these appearances is I love to hear from people and what they think and what's on their mind. So I hope lots of them will come by on November 13th and tell me what they think.
Lynn, thanks for your time today.
See you later, Paul.
Lynn Scherr on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.